Welcome back, everyone. It works to have your video on. It's very nice to be able to see people. So if that can work for you, much appreciated. Yeah. So again, greetings and welcome back, everyone. Again, those just coming back, if it is possible to have your video on, it's nice to see people. But that may not work for technical reasons. Many of the last years, I've devoted at least a month, sometimes 2 months, to a personal retreat. And I actually came on Saturday from 4 weeks on retreat. Nancy also was part of this retreat. You can wave, Nancy. And often in the last years, I've scheduled a Wednesday gathering right after the retreat because I love to share some about the retreat, what was alive, and what particularly is what I can draw from the retreat, both of a personal nature, but also that can really be shared in terms of aspects of our practice that can be of value more generally. And that's what I want to do, really under the rubric of what helps us to deepen our practice. And I'll mention some of the insights and fruits and learnings from my own retreat by identifying a number of ways that we can deepen our practice. And so my invitation is to listen. I'll probably name like 10 or 12 different ways of deepening practice. And you may want to sign on for all 12 of them. But my suggestion is that you listen for the one or two or three that call you, that you might be able to bring into your practice right now, that you might be able really to connect with. And so in that way, I hope that my own sharing about my own experience can be a catalyst and give energy for deepening practice by really seeing what calls you in terms of taking your next step. I think for me, you know, having practiced for nearly 50 years, right at the center of what helps us to continually deepen our practice, and it's really another way of saying deepening our lives, deepening in the capacity to touch our own wisdom, our own love, our own understanding of our own personal gifts for the world. That the key to that is knowing often what comes next. What are my next one or two steps? What's calling me at this time? And so I will share some of my own experience and name a number of different ways of deepening practice and invite you to listen for what really resonates with you and what you might implement in your own life. So definitely don't do all 12. That's too much. But rather see, again, the one or two or three that call you. So I was able to do a four-week retreat at Spirit Rock, which I've done many times, actually, almost every year for 25 years. And so it's familiar, it's almost like it's on my schedule, which is very nice. And retreats are a very important way of deepening practice. I like to think of them as a kind of intensive training in our mindfulness, our concentration, our equanimity, our clarity, different qualities. And there can, you know, the retreat can be half a day, one week, 1 month, but think of them as a little more extended time than we might usually have for intensive training. Really valuable to go into that intensive training periodically, where we are able for a longer period of time than normal to focus on these qualities. So that may call you, but it may not, you know, we don't start with a month. When I was first meditating, 3 hours seemed like a big deal. And it was. You know, it was a lot. So we look for our next steps. And the value of retreats and the training, particularly when they're a little longer, is that we can get away from our usual routines, almost like our usual sense of self, and really be available for messages that might not come when we're overly busy. Maybe our own intuitions of what's calling me, what's deeply calling me as what I want in my life, what I want next, where I can be more spacious. It has some of the qualities, maybe like a vacation, where we get enough away from our everyday busyness so that something else can be there, some other qualities can be there. And so retreats are wonderful for training. And they have their ups and downs, right? They're not just a wonderful onward to continual bliss. Despite what we have in our Spirit Rock advertising, like I like to be playful and say that if we were to be honest in our Spirit Rock advertising, we would probably say, come, be on retreat, have more difficult experiences than you thought you were going to have. Be in contact with your top 10 neuroses. You know, learn about them. You know, develop more equanimity. And so forth. We don't exactly say that, but that's actually what happens. Right? The retreats can be both wonderful and deepening and concentration and clarity, but there's also a way that we encounter our stuff more directly, you know, and there can be actually ways of learning that are deeply healing. I know a lot of my particularly my early retreats, I would often have stuff come up that was hard. And it would be there for quite a while. I had one retreat where I had fear was predominant for most of 10 days. It wasn't real, real intense, but it was there, right? And I was just with the fear for most of the time. And I had good guidance. I got to study the fear. Fear has never been the same, right? Because luckily it wasn't of an overwhelming nature, you know, but it was in a workable nature, but it was still fear. You know, other retreats where I had anger really, really strong for a retreat, you know. And, you know, other kind of challenging states and a lot of strong self-judgment. So, when it's in the workable range, we can actually learn tremendously from those, you know. But it needs to be workable. If it's not workable, we need to do things which keep us with balance. But the retreats are all not just wonderful, blissful, you know, and people aren't always mindful. I was noticing this, you know, at a retreat, we all have our retreat job. And my job was to clean 2 bathrooms every day. which I actually asked for that job because I really like it. And so my job was to clean the bathrooms. And interesting to notice that there was we had in the bathrooms we use brown towels, which are put into a separate container for composting. And then we also have a separate trash bin. And every day I would come in and clean bathroom. We had very clear signs, this container only for brown towels, this container only for trash, put brown towels in the brown towel container. I would come in every day and take out trash from the brown towel container and take out brown towels from the trash container. Was there mindfulness with the people using the brown towels and the trash? Maybe there was a little bit of slippage, right? Anyway, that's just the nature of things, but it was kind of humorous coming in every day and saying, "Okay, how many brown towels will be in the trash today?" And there were other things. People left brown towels all over the floors. Anyway, so maybe they were just deep in some other concentration. Who knows? I'm not going to try to be judgmental. I was trying to raise this just to say there's not mindfulness all the time necessarily, but it's a training. And during the retreat, I did a number of practices, and I'll talk a little bit more about some of them. You know, my kind of foundational default practice was to be with awareness, kind of a large, vast awareness. That was my default practice, just to be with that as much as the time, as much of the time as possible, to be with that kind of awareness, and to, for me, I often would let it be infused by the metta. We've talked sometimes about the radiating metta. And so my default practice, when I would walk around, I would be just with this large awareness infused by metta, being with the people, being with the, we had a lot of turkeys around, crows, sometimes peahens, and also with the trees. I would just be with this large awareness with the trees, the flowers, the bushes. That was my default practice that was there in the dining hall and most of the time. And a lot of another emphasis was continuity, wanting to have my practice be as continuous moment to moment, not just in the formal meditation, but in the dining hall and in my room and times when it wasn't exactly a formal meditation. And also, I did an energy practice, which I'll talk about a little later, which was very, very helpful. And so let me mention now some of the learning that I had. And listen for what, again, what resonates for you, for the one or two or three things. How do we remember, both in retreat and in daily life, the core intention of our practice, which is to be awake? Remember, the name Buddha more or less means the one who is awake. And the goal of our practice is to be awake and aware all the time. What one can find in retreat, which can be really inspiring, is that certainly after periods of practice, so it's different for different people, but I would say for myself, after quite a bit of practice, I can really experience continual awareness for stretches of time where it's really mostly aware, could be 90% aware in meditation and in walking around. So I just want to report that the goal of being continuously aware is possible. It's not some pipe dream from 2600 years ago. The challenge is to bring that into daily life, right? But one can experience it on retreat and then increasingly experience that in daily life. And so part of what we can have that deepens our practice is to continually remember, to find ways to remember the core intention to be aware now. Am I aware now during the day? Just to keep coming back, not to have some standard that you compare yourself to of being aware all the time, but we want to just find ways during the day to keep coming back to awareness, to keep coming back to mindfulness, to keep remembering the intention. How do we have that be an important part of our daily lives? To remember, to be aware, to be compassionate, to be present. Retreats help us experience that more typically than we do during daily life, but this is our potential. And we can talk about it in terms of awareness, mindfulness, also compassion and kindness. How can I be more and more with compassion and kindness? How can that be more and more with my daily flow? And again, what helps me to remember? You know, it might be coming back to intentions. One of the practices I do is four times a day, before breakfast, in the morning, in the afternoon, the evening, I come back for about 2 or 3 minutes. I almost like say my vows and I bring back my fundamental intentions. Doesn't have to be 2 or 3 minutes. It could be 30 seconds a few times a day, remembering what's important. There are many ways to do it, but can I remember the intention to be aware, to have kindness there? And it doesn't matter really if I have the intention and then 3 minutes later, I'm not aware. It's just continually remembering and coming back. And so, you know, concretely, we might say, can I find a place where I want to, for the next period of time, want to remember to be aware? Maybe I say, I want to be aware when I'm cooking. Or I want to be aware 1 meal a day when I'm eating. Or when I'm taking a walk. You know, can I have that intention to remember? And again, this practice of pausing or stopping, kind of doing a reset, is really, really crucial. Can we have a way of pausing during the day? It might be to say, again, what's my next step? It might be to have 1 or 2 or 3 pauses during the day that you do, that you bring in. Doesn't have to take time, and it doesn't even have to have any particular results, but we just do this pausing. One of my edges of practice is bringing awareness when I'm on the computer. Anyone do awareness practice on the computer? It's not easy, right? At least for me, it's not easy. And so one of the practices I do, I have a recording on my computer that I play a lot of the time, which is a 45-minute recording in which a bell is rung every 5 minutes. And when I hear the bell, I stop for a few moments. It's a nice recording to have. I got it off, you know, off some meditation site, but you could do something like that. You could actually do that just on your own, make your own recording. Anyway, so that's remembering the core intention for wisdom, awareness, and kindness. How do we do that? How do we bring that in? You know, that was important for me on the retreat. And again, see what, another thing that I looked for near the end of the retreat, which I often suggest for people, is this practice of getting a sense of what the next step is. What's my next step in my practice? What's my learning edge, right? And I like to, towards the end of a retreat, ask myself, is there some clarity about any shifts, might be relatively minor shifts in my life after the retreat. We can ask this just during our everyday lives. What's my learning edge? What's the next step for me? Again, not being overly ambitious. It might be doing something that like I just mentioned. It might be bringing in a pause a few times a day or setting intentions a few times a day. And we don't need to be a certain place or compare ourselves with anyone else, but just see what is very personal. What's my own learning edge? What calls me? What's doable, not overly ambitious? For me, this is the secret of developing in practice. The secret of deepening is being in touch as much as possible with one's own personal learning edge and knowing what it is. And again, it needs to be doable, not overly ambitious. Related to that, which is again important for me, that I often look at the end of a retreat, is what's important for me in my life? How do I prioritize? You know, again, one of the nice things about a retreat is that one can be away from the ordinary activities and not so caught up. And so, you know, for me, a question that I sometimes ask, that I asked in this retreat, is what do I want to prioritize in the next period of time? Is there something I want to let go of? What do I want to do more, as it were, or do less? And this was certainly really crucial. We get busy. We often have a lot of habits, patterns, activities that we're involved in, which may or may not be serving us. So it's a really crucial question. What's important for me? What do I want to prioritize? And a retreat's really good for that because we get some space. Maybe a vacation is helpful for that. But what, you know, and what to let go of? And what to, you know, for me, one thing I wanted to prioritize, you know, it wasn't not a surprise, but for me a priority is to have more actual formal practice. I, you know, do a fair amount, but more called for me. And I also want to prioritize my writing. You know, I think I've mentioned that I'm, you know, trying to finish a book on transforming the judgmental mind. And I often joke that if I hadn't done as much internal work with my own judgmental mind and been judging myself harshly for the progress of the book, I probably would have finished the book earlier. So I'm going to put that in my foreword about how all my internal work has led to the book not being finished as soon as I would like. Anyway, for me, wanted to prioritize practice and writing. And what do I let go of? There were some things that came to me to let go of to make more time. And I wanted to develop more of a routine. So my plan is as much as possible to keep my mornings free, particularly for practice and writing, aside from Wednesday mornings, and not to schedule things in the morning as much as possible, not always possible, but to really keep some boundaries, prioritize, let go, you know. And so, you know, what occurs to us? What's most important for me? And am I giving it enough time and space? Do I need to let go of something? Important questions, you know, and even maybe let me just stop and let there be 30 seconds of silence. What's calling each of us? Is there something to let go of? Another part of my retreat that was really important, which I haven't talked about so much here, is the importance of, for me in my practice, of what I would call energy work or energy practice or work with what we sometimes call the subtle body, the energy body. I was doing about 2 hours of practice during this retreat, actually a Tibetan practice called Chumo, which was the main practice of Milarepa, who's up here on my wall. In Tibet, it's said to be an inner fire practice, which keeps you warm during the cold winter. And they actually had reports of people doing this practice who would have a contest to see who could dry the most number of towels in an hour. Anyway, I didn't get so much into drying towels on this retreat, but I've been doing the practice for six years. And it's really important, and it really brings me into a lot of familiarity with the kind of the subtle energy of the body, which you can also explore in other ways. People can explore this in yoga, right? Or sometimes in qigong, or in some of the, you know, in different traditions, yoga traditions, Taoist traditions, from the Chinese tradition, work with the chakras and so forth. But it's, for me, a really crucial practice because it really can result in the mind being really, really filled with the subtle energy, no thoughts. It really is connected with an end to conceptualization and a sense of both the inner body and the outer world being just this orb of radiating subtle energy. Everything being of that nature. How many people have experienced that in some ways, maybe through yoga? Yeah, it can be a wonderful practice. And it's not, you know, it's brought in some yoga and some qigong, but I found it really helpful, particularly helpful for us to the extent that we're in a more mental culture, because it kind of takes us deeply into the body and deeply into the energy of the body. So really, really crucial. And I actually was reading fairly recently that there's a Christian mystic and writer named Cynthia Bourgeau who says that she thinks that this was very much part of the practice of Jesus and that people can't really understand and go deeply into the life of Jesus without bringing in the subtle body practices. Very interesting. You might look her up, Cynthia Bourgeau, Bourgeault, I think is the spelling. Very interesting writing. Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm continuing to name possible practices for deepening practice, possible dimensions for our own next steps. Another practice which was really important for me during the retreat was one that I have taught on at some length on Wednesdays, and this is the practice of not doing. There's a very crucial place for doing in our meditation. Remember that the, you know, skillful effort is one of the factors of the Eightfold Path, right? And you know, the instructions that I gave this morning for meditation were about focusing on the anchor, the breath, the, you know, another anchor, and continually noticing what's there, labeling it, naming. These are all forms of doing and very, very crucial. You know, the Buddha said, all things are impermanent. Work out your own practice with continual care and energy. You know, it's a kind of effort. And yet there's also a dimension of our practice, particularly more at an intermediate or advanced level, where we open up to non-doing. A really crucial part of my retreat was to just invite the awareness itself to, as it were, be in charge. Without me being in charge, you know, just invite, you know, kind of my own inner wisdom merging with the wisdom of the mind and heart and body, and with something larger than myself, inviting that to be there. You know, again, this presumes that we've done a certain amount of doing, but there's this place for non-doing, letting go, letting the meditator get out of the way. And this was an important part of my retreat. And again, noticing sometimes where I'm overdoing it. And this occurs, as we looked at in our times when we studied this, and the recordings for those sessions are on the website Dharma Seed. You can go back and look at that. I think I gave 4 or 5 talks called Doing and Not Doing in Meditation and Daily Life. Really crucial topic. And it's something that we know in many ways. One of the ways that we know this is through what's sometimes called the flow experience, where we can know maybe in creative work, if we're doing writing or poetry or art, you can notice that sometimes you just let go and let the process occur. You can notice this in something like dancing, right? You know, at a certain point, I'm not doing the dance is doing me. How many people know that from creative work or dancing? It's also there very much in something like sports. You know, they have the phrase in sports, being in the zone, right? One of my friends, Andrew Cooper, wrote a book about being, it was called Playing in the Zone. And, you know, it's very well known in sports that at a certain point, you know, one's not doing, you're just in the flow. And often the most powerful and beautiful experiences in sports come out of that, can really be there. There's a sense of that flow of being fully absorbed, but in a sense, I'm not doing it. The activity is doing me, in a sense. Again, how many people know some version of that? Really important. And it can also be a quality of our meditation, of our spiritual life. You know, again, in many traditions, you know, I'm thinking particularly of Christian and Jewish traditions, but also Islamic, words something like, not my will, but thy will, are there at a certain point in the traditions. This is from the great Tibetan teacher Longchenpa. Awakened mind is by nature primordially pure. And so what should you do? Let your mind and body relax deeply in a carefree state with an easygoing attitude like a person who has nothing to do. Interestingly, these are advanced meditation instructions. The advanced meditation instructions, don't do anything. There's a little bit of humor to that, right? We have to do a lot, put a lot of effort out till we get to the place of not doing. But we probably know something like that from the places where we have expertise, you know, whatever it might be in our lives, whether, you know, what maybe in our work, that you had to train a lot, get to a certain point, and then at a certain point, you're beyond needing to focus so much and you're just doing it without even focusing. Again, very much like being in the flow. Another version of the advanced meditation instructions: if you meditate again and again, you will see that there is nothing to cultivate in meditation. Nothing to cultivate in meditation. This is the meditation of omnipresent awareness. Again, an advanced instruction about this deep, expansive awareness. Another emphasis that was really important for me, I mentioned earlier, this is something, again, we looked at, I think, in January. This was the connection of the metta and the wisdom. And so for me, really important to have these connections between the wisdom, the awareness, and the heart qualities. Again, sometimes separate in our practice. And again, this is why for me, radiating metta was a foundational practice during the retreat. A further emphasis that was really crucial was to continually come back. If I'm lost, if I'm thinking a lot, how do we come back? You know, what are ways that you come back in daily life? What helps you to come back when you're stuck or lost, caught in reactivity? What helps you to do that? What helps us to come back? It's helpful to have almost like a routine. Here's what I do when I'm stuck. Here's what I do when I'm lost. Here's what I do when I'm not present, to keep coming back. Similarly, how do I remember what's most important in a moment? What helps me to remember what's most important? I often go into conversations that are, you know, maybe especially where there's some challenge, and I have the intention to bring in kindness. I may forget that intention 5 minutes after the conversation starts, but the intention is really helpful. So these are all ways of deepening practice, all things that we can bring into our daily life. And again, what I'm inviting is finding a way to find one or two or three of these that you want to maybe do for the next week that really are calling you. So we want to listen for what may have resonated. And I've mentioned, again, 10 or 12 ways of deepening practice. Which of those have called you? Do you have a sense of what your next step or two is in your practice? And maybe you, even before this talk, you already knew what it is and you're in the middle of it. That's fine. But it's really helpful to get a sense of, here's my learning edge. Here's my growing edge. Here's my next step. So here's a closing quotation. This is from a well-known meditation teacher that I think everyone here knows, named Sylvia Boorstein. I'm just joking. Sylvia, this is from Sylvia, from her book, Pay Attention, For Goodness Sake. Okay, this is from Sylvia. It's clear to me that my journey from confusion to clarity and from closed heart to open heart is one of continual arrivals and departures, a lifelong process that happens over and over again, every day. I'm fine with that. I love the story of the Buddha's enlightenment. The message of the story, that arriving at freedom and happiness is a possibility, reminds me that I too can arrive, even if it is again and again, rather than once and for all. If it is again and again arriving at that experience of clarity and happiness. So thank you, Sylvia. And let's just rest for a moment now and reflect on what may have been important from the talk. Reflect on your sense, if this resonated with you, of your next step, your own edge of practice. Take a minute or two now to reflect. let's open things up now to discussion. Could be sharing something, asking a question. We could come back to some of what people shared at the end of the meditation if we want to, if that's helpful. Some of the challenging situations, we could go into that. Anyone want to share, ask a question, clarification about something? We can, again, do it just by raising your hand, because I can see people, or you could use the raised hand function. Okay, Larry, please. Still muted, Larry.
Yeah, touched on the picture instead of unmute. Can you hear me now?
I can, yeah. Good.
Okay. A person asked that I thought it was an interesting question. He said, if someone is deaf from birth, what language do they think in?
Well, someone deaf from birth.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, gosh. I don't know the answer. I can make a guess. Maybe we have an expert among our group. But my guess would be that they get, instructed in the language of the deaf from, at the appropriate time, and that they learn that, and whether, probably in some way in the language of the place where they live, but that's a guess.
Yeah.
Do you have any knowledge of that, Larry?
That would be my guess too.
Yeah.
No knowledge of it.
Anyone in our community here have knowledge of that? Okay. Yeah, that'd be my guess, Larry. And maybe we can look into that and come back next week.
Okay. Thanks.
Because I'm sure the answer is out there. But that'd be both of our guesses that the language would be through some other means than the ordinary one. Yeah. Yeah. Nancy, and then Viv, yeah, and then Sarah, yeah, and then Liz, yeah, please.
Good morning, everybody. I just want to share a wonderful thing that was a byproduct of my retreat. I have been, despite practicing not as long as Donald, but for 14 years, I have been meta-averse for most of that time. And in this retreat, there was a period of time when we were offered the option to do metta practice for several days. And when normally I would have said, no, I'll just continue on with what I had been doing, I decided, well, this is as good a time as any to try an intensive metta practice, where basically you're, like Donald is aware all the time, you are basically practicing metta, using phrases or reading metta all day long. And what happened was surprising and a little bit astounding and very happy. In the course of that time, it created a great deal of joy for me, and I came up with a metta phrase to address my self-judgment. May I accept and love all parts of me just as I am, because I have an intolerance for the shadow parts of my being. And what I found was that as I was in meditation, when self-judgmental thoughts would arise, the metta phrase, without intention, would just automatically come to me. And the value of the intensive metta is that you are training your mind and your heart to respond with metta, and it seems to work. And so two things that have happened since I came home. I was for a walk, and I came to a crosswalk, and there was a stream of cars going by, and someone finally stopped to let me go in the crosswalk, and my impulse was to turn and bow, which is a very common reaction when you're on retreat in Sangha with a lot of people. And the other thing was when I do a 15-mile bike ride every Wednesday morning, and while I was on my bike ride, my mind was occupied with this little metta song that I sing. May all be filled with loving kindness. May all be well. May all be peaceful and at ease. May all be happy. And what a wonderful thing to have in your mind for a continual period of time. It's been just the most wonderful byproduct of my retreat. So yeah. Highly recommend metta.
Well, beautiful and wonderful that you really were open to that exploration. Yeah, you might not have been. And yeah, that you stayed with it, and it probably might have been a little bit of a struggle at the beginning, but you stayed with it, right? And the other thing I want to point out is the way that when you were doing that practice, the phrases would come in, and maybe the song would come in without your intending it. That's that quality of not doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
That there's something, you set up something, and it's just happening because mm-hmm. of the practice. Very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you, Nis. And nice to share a month with you, yeah. Viv, Sarah, and then Liz, if she's still there. Yeah. You're muted, Viv, yeah. Still muted. There you go.
Okay. First, I would like to thank Nancy for sharing that. That was really beautiful. I've done a little bit of that, doing metta all the time. I found out about it online. I don't know, some group in some country was doing that for metta. And I found it, and it had an amazing effect. Okay, so... what I wanted to say was that I related to what you talked about with not doing
yeah.
as a way to deepen your practice. But you helped me realize that I've been doing it. And when that started happening, I thought I was doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And I was quite worried about myself. So just, I guess it started maybe a month ago or so. Suddenly I wasn't able to follow my breath in a way that I had been from beginning to end, and noticing the nuance and how one breath is different from another. And then one day it was much more open in my mind.
Yeah.
And I ended up with the internal space and the external space around me being very, well, I'm going to say spacious, being very big when the meditation was over. And it stayed with me for a good part of the day and helped me become aware. But I thought that when I lost that ability to, like, name everything and note what I'm doing and really trying so hard to be aware of each little thing, I thought when I lost that something was wrong, but now I'm thinking that something was very right, and I increased my sitting time because I increased my sitting time with the intention to increase it before I sat, and I used to do maybe 20 to 30 minutes,
yeah.
and now I'm up to 37 minutes,
yeah.
And I'm increasing it day by day, so thank you. At least it seems like it's the same thing for validating what happened to me.
Yeah, it sounds like almost like, tell me if this resonates, but almost like, you know, there was this, you know, in many ways valuable practice of being really precise and noticing details, but maybe your being without even being conscious felt it was a little tight or a little bit overly tight, and then it seems like you opened up to something that was a little more open and spacious, and this just took you to another place, right?
Yes.
Does that resonate? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah. and that it was, you know, the whole, it was kind of coming out of almost like your own deep intuitive wisdom.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, which you can trust. Of course, we can fool ourselves with that, but you have that experience, and you can trust that there is, we all have this deep personal wisdom. And, you know, and again, it's a whole discussion to know how do we know when it's that and we're not fooling ourselves. But I'm, what you're describing sounds very genuine to me. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Viv.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.